From Midori House, welcome to Sunday Brunch here on Monocle 24. I'm Paul Osborne. Coming up today, an artistic bent to the start of the programme. We'll hear from one person who puts emojis into his paintings, then a composer whose latest work draws on space exploration. And later on,
bright colour, round shapes, symmetry, abundance, a sense of lightness or elevation. Those things, I call them aesthetics of joy because they are hardwired triggers that we find in the world that can actually produce the feeling of joy inside of us.
We'll get some advice on how to bring joy into the workplace. We'll also sample some highly popular buns and take a look through the weekend's papers. All to come in the next hour on Sunday Brunch, live from London on Monocle 24. Well, welcome to today's Sunday Brunch. Later on, we will take a detailed look through the newspapers, as we say, just very quickly. Guess what's on the front page of the British newspapers this morning? Yes, heavens, it's Brexit. Sunday Times says we shouldn't go on holiday. British people shouldn't be booking any holidays after the 29th of March next year. That's reassuring. Meanwhile, the Sunday Telegraph, far more optimistic, quoting the Foreign Secretary, saying that the UK will flourish if we leave the European Union without a deal. And the Observer pointing out that we spend so much time talking about Brexit that we haven't bothered to deal with any of the other issues that are affecting the country for the last 2 years. Anyway, we'll discuss all that when we take a look through the newspapers a little over half an hour from now. We're going to begin, though, by talking about art. We have a couple of guests to talk to this morning. Our first is an artist who works across a range of mediums, painting, sculpture, even furniture. And in a new show that opens later this week in London, Philip Cobber returns to painting, focusing on the digital world. He's with me in the studio now. I mentioned there that you know, you work across all sorts of painting, sculpture, furniture, clothing.
Yeah.
Is painting at the top of the list, though? Is that the kind of the first love, as it were?
Definitely. The beauty of painting is it's such a deep sort of historical dialogue. If you think about the sort of the history of painting and so many, you know, hundreds of years that people have been basically contributing to this very rich dialogue. So it's you know, and the dialogue of storytelling, and also this, and it's sort of been at the forefront of a lot of artistic sort of philosophical, I guess, questions and things. So I think for me that the art form of painting is an amazingly historical art form, and because, you know, some people would say, oh, is painting relevant anymore, blah blah blah. But when you're looking at something that basically has existed for so long, then the dialogue of the thing itself is actually makes it an art form, you know, that historical conversation. So in a way, my works are very much like anchored within this idea of painting, this historical idea of painting, but then also trying to integrate that with the contemporary age and sort of contemporary pop culture, basically.
That's what I want to talk more about, that because obviously we're at a vague disadvantage discussing painting on the radio because people can't see the paintings.
Yeah.
But your work has in the past been compared to people like, you know, Roy Lichtenstein, Andy Warhol, things like that. Is there a risk that that's a slightly sort of lazy stereotype to say this is somebody who involves elements of popular culture in their painting?
Of course. I mean, the thing is, some people, when they hear the word pop, they think, oh, pop's a cheesy, cheap thing that was fun in the 60s, but now we're bored of it. We've seen enough soup cans, thank you very much. But in my mind, there's something much more deep to pop. For me, pop is actually more of a commitment to a language of the everyday, the intimacy of the everyday, and also the holiness of the everyday. The holiness of the everyday life, almost the dismantling of the grand notions of superiority that often exist in art. The idea of this sort of tortured genius that's somehow more elevated in his vision than your average person. I'm actually more into the average person in terms of celebrating the genius of the everyday, the intimacy of the everyday, the meaning of the everyday. And so that's when I use pop as a philosophy, I'm using this idea of the language of the everyday, symbols, brands, things that we're deeply connected with, like from the fridge.
You mentioned the soup can a moment ago, which is everyone's sort of first thought of Andy Warhol.
Of it. It's a sort of conceptual icon of mass production, you know, art, whatever, you know, sort of idea, which is obviously followed on from like a Duchampian idea of the urinal, the ready-made object or something being recycled into an artwork. So it's a sort of follow-on of that. And it's obviously it's a cornerstone of pop in a way, like the idea of Western pop theory.
But some of your works will have things like emojis in them, or windows from computer monitors.
I mean, literally try to put everything in there. It's like a sort of edit of everything. I like to think of my paintings as like sort of, I mean, first of all, the main thread in the paintings is my alter ego Lobster, sort of cartoon character who's a sort of symbolic of me, really. They're sort of maps, the mind maps of my dialogue with art. And my dialogue with art is fundamentally a sort of, you know, a sort of celebration of the language of art and the possibilities of art. So pushing this language and trying to break forward in new ways of, you know, what paint can achieve in a way. But it's also just a diagram of like an individual's association with history and how, I like to think of my paintings as symbolic to anyone being able to basically put themselves into context with great figures of art history and just put themselves beside and, you know, take the piss out of Picasso or, you know, turn Van Gogh upside down. And that's the beauty of being able to have a dialogue with things. You know, you don't have to be crushed by the past. You can actually turn it upside down. You can play with it. It's language, you know, you can rewrite things, you can come up with things, you know. So I like to basically use all these appropriated icons as references to how I can reinterpret and recontextualize language.
You talked a moment ago about the sort of the holiness, you actually said, of everyday life. And you said that there are lots of people who have drawn on popular culture but those reference points that you make often come from a sort of digital culture.
Yeah.
And there's an argument that that has been very democratizing.
Yeah, well, very much. I mean, the thing is, with the funny thing with the internet, it's very split because obviously in one hand, there's an amazing utopian idea of it, like a huge democratic opportunity for everyone to express themselves and have platforms and communicate. And like, it's very liberating if you think about it, because the previous structures of power that used to exist around art was very, obviously very typically guarded and very much hierarchical and institutional. You know, it was very, you know, not inclusive at all and very elitist, obviously, in some senses. And so there's something about the internet that's incredibly powerful and ideologically. But obviously what we've come to find with the internet is that in reality what's happened is, you know, big systems, big networks end up controlling information, and there's patterns, and, you know, the reality is obviously quite different than the freedom, than the ideology. But I think, in my mind, I think that's such a classic situation in life where you've got huge opportunity, but sometimes things don't always go, you know, turn out the way you'd ideally like them and stuff. So, but I think there's always that tension, that possibility with the internet that you can still break through. You know, there's still that opportunity for people. I mean, the thing is, what's quite sad though is I was chatting to the head of a big tech company recently, and they were telling me the average person consumes 36 meters of data on their phone. Like, they scroll 36 meters a day of data and retain very, very little. And they're on studies, basically, creativity in the UK with kids is at the all-time low. It's like never been as low in terms of, so it's almost pacifying this huge creative opportunity is pacifying people and actually not making them create. So obviously that's the real challenge with digital culture and everything. But I personally find that, you know, yes, I'm sure I'm probably addicted at times to social media and stuff in a way that's not necessarily positive. But then at the same time, I still find this amazing opportunity to learn things and connect and like, and so there's definitely lots of positives too. It's just that struggle to push, you know, find, yeah, to control it
the,
and
the
find,
right
yeah.
way to kind
yeah
of...
and try and I think, you know, I'm optimistic about it and potentially, but I do see there's very dark elements to it too. So.
Because the companies that push this will tell you that these are extraordinary tools for creativity.
Yeah.
You buy a tablet or a phone, so you can make music on it. You have,
of course,
everyone's given software on their phone that's more powerful than a recording studio, but nobody uses it.
Exactly, it's like the dream versus reality. It's a bit like actually the reason why my new show is actually Hunt paintings is the reason why I've been really pushing this violence in a way, this structures of like of hunting and like and these more traditional sort of conceived sort of more violent elevated imagery is because actually the paintings are actually trying to reflect in a way the complexity of pop culture. In general, it's not, you know, the 60s pop culture was often very idealized. Do you know, it was very much pure, you know, ideology, you know, like the perfect American dream, you know, the dream life, you know, and the beauty of that. But I believe that as consumers and as a culture, we've become much more aware of the darkness, the shadow of pop culture in a way. So even though I love to celebrate that, the beauty and the positive energy in it, but there's still the really strong dark undertone. And I think my paintings do, I think, have that juxtaposition between hyper pop, hyper alive and hyper positive, yet with a very strong dark undertone. So then I think that for me, that's the essence of so much, you know, that dialogue between the light and dark. So, yeah.
Now, I have to ask you about something you mentioned a little bit earlier, your alter ego.
Yeah. Yeah, so anyway, my alter ego is a lobster, which is something that's really, you know, now for me, it's a really important part of my work in a way, because it, you know, a lot of artists in reality create these sort of personas that become like Grayson Perry wearing a dress, or the legend of Dali, or, you know, there's obviously, we're very aware in branding terms or in storytelling terms how the idea of the persona is such a large part of the value of something associated artwork, because obviously just associated to the person that made it. So for me, the cartoon lobster character really just evolved out of my interest in symbolism, and the fact that I always used this little cartoon lobster drawing as a sort of sign off somehow, as like my little doodle of because I love surrealism and I like the idea of being a protagonist of surrealism somehow. And so that sort of evolved, that little drawing, and then I was
now
making.
He is in a lot of the paintings.
Yeah, so he's the protagonist in all the paintings, and also I'm building this sort of VR world. At the moment, which is called Lobsterland, and it's actually his world where I'm making a world for him to live, and that's very exciting, because it's, you know, the idea of VR is like it takes this notion of painting another step, because you can really start to play around with all the other elements, so the nuts and bolts of experience and interplay, and being able to, for people to somehow actually turn them, put themselves into a Dali painting and turn around the corner and
So again, in a way, that is kind of celebrating the potential, the creative potential
of
this culture. People scrolling taking anything in.
I was actually thinking about this morning, just in the back of my head, how VR is quite interesting space right now, because I was thinking about how at the beginning of the internet, there was all this possibility, this creative possibility with it, like, because it was before it had been heavily commercialized. So it was a very liberating space where people where people could create new systems, and it was quite, there was a lot of freedom in it in a way, because it created new opportunities for things. And then it obviously, things became very big business and regulated, and then it sort of changed. And I was thinking, what's interesting with the VR space is people try to commercialize it, it hasn't really commercialized. And I was thinking it's an interesting platform in a way, where I was imagining maybe that could be an interesting place for a subculture to start evolving. And I think we've seen it obviously in like Ready Player One, that interesting Spielberg movie, which was just a postulation on this idea of creating new realities and everything. But I think, you know, it's very, very interesting. I mean, the gallery I'm working with in London, with specifically with this Saatchi show, called Unit London, work a lot with digital media, and like they use digital media very much to communicate, social media to communicate art and things, and it's interesting how these digital forms are so powerful today.
And that exhibition opens this week, doesn't it?
Yeah. So the exhibition opening is tomorrow night. Yeah.
And so just tell us, that's at the Saatchi Gallery in...
It's at the Saatchi Gallery in off the King's Road, and it's my largest exhibition to date in the UK, and it's three rooms, and it has I've got like a couple of large 6 meter paintings in it, sort of my attempt to sort of touch that sort of epic scale of like the old masters creating like amazing sort of wall frescoes or church interiors. I was really interested in just trying to really push an epic sort of elevated pop image of pop somehow. And then in addition to that, so there's some new sculpture works and things, a lot of lobsters, and then there's the Lobsterland VR experience.
Excellent. The exhibition through till the 13th of January 2019. Philip, thank you very much.
Thanks for having
me coming in this morning.
Board.
Stay with us in just a moment. We'll turn to music later on too. We'll find out how to bring joy into our lives, as well as taking a look through the weekend's papers, which may be a little less joyful. This is Monocle 24.
The Monocle Weekly, our original Sunday show, brings you the best interviews with the writers, artists, thinkers, and innovators that shape our times. Also featuring fearless presenters.
It's not illegal, but it does have an effect.
Uh-oh. Are you ready for this, Tom?
I could do with some stimulation and some relaxation. How traumatized am I going
to
be?
How much of this do we need to drink to get an effect?
All of it.
Who ask the probing questions.
What is the kinkiest animal?
The mantis.
That's pretty kinky.
Headless thrusting.
and a good old-fashioned star turn or two, just for good measure.
We had a small editorial conference today where everyone was going, what do you think of Kylie's concert? When did you go? When are you going? What's happening?
So, yeah, I heard you guys had a debrief.
Yeah, we've had a debrief.
That's the Monocle Weekly. Sundays at 12 noon London time on Monocle 24. You wouldn't want to finish your week without it.
The cosmos is all that is, or ever was, or ever will be. We know we are approaching the end of this mysteries.
Last year, Paul Kirkpatrick, my apologies, released his debut album to critical acclaim. His latest recording, you just heard a little of it there, includes tracks like that one, named after Carl Sagan. The album draws on space exploration, but asks a number of questions about it as well. And Paul's with me in the studio this morning. Thank you very much for coming in. I was listening to it last night, and the first obvious is why space? Why the interest, the fascination wanting to explore that?
Yep. It's the interest in space and man's interest in space, but also it's tied back to this, we don't seem to want to be alone. Are we alone in space? But then you tie that back to loneliness on our own planet. So people are lonely in their own lives, but we're worried about being lonely in space. Are we the only race in space? So the album tries to tie all of that together. So the race to get into space and all the billions of pounds spent on space in the juxtaposition of loneliness on our own planet and people not wanting to be alone, whether it's on the planet or in space, it seems to be a reoccurring theme that goes on. So the album tries to take those different things like religion and space exploration and the fact that the universe is nearly 14 billion years old and we have only been exploring space for 50 years. So a minute part of time. And maybe 10 billion years ago, the universe was teeming with life and it's faded out. So it looks at all those different aspects of the space race and of social media and loneliness and all those kind of things.
Quite often when people write music and they're inspired by those ideas of space exploration, it can have a sort of esoteric, sort of dreamlike quality to it. One of the things that's very interesting about this is the use of all this archive audio. We were hearing a little bit of it just there.
Yep.
I mean, where did you find all of those?
I did a lot of research, and during my research, I actually came across two professors at Oxford University talking about the Fermi paradox. So Enrico Fermi's famous quote, "Where is everybody?" And there's a thing at Oxford University called the Fine Tuning Project, where they discuss all of these things, and they have videos and podcasts and things. And I came across Professor Silk and Professor Livio talking about it. So I approached Oxford University and they gave me permission to use some of the audio. And then I started doing a bit more work on NASA and Frank Drake and Carl Sagan and all those kind of people. And actually everybody was very eager to allow me to use the samples that I took from those different places. So yeah, it's just a bit of research. There was a Horizon documentary on about 18 months ago called Strange Signals from Outer Space. And that was the initial thing that triggered me thinking about it all. And that had Carl Sagan and Frank Drake and all those kind of people on there. So I started doing a bit more research into it. And I find when I write music, if you're writing about a theme, it tends to flow a lot better. So, you know, you've got, if you look at space, you've got the universe, creation, the Big Bang, and then bring in religion and all those other things. They all go into like the mixing pot. And then if you look at the last track, the Arecibo message, that was us, the first transmission in 1974, sending a message into space aimed at a particular galaxy in space, which, interestingly enough, if somebody did answer that message, it would take 50,000 years to get back to us. So none of us would be here to hear it anyway, but it's a fascinating subject to look at.
You mentioned that juxtaposition between the sort of the isolation that many people feel here on Earth and that sort of quest to feel that we are not alone. Do you think that really is the driving force behind space exploration, or is it a way for people to make it relatable? to the general public? Because I suppose if you say we want to spend billions of pounds to go to Mars to see what's there, people will just go, well, that's an odd use of money. But if you say you never know, maybe there's life on Mars, it engages people more.
I think it does. I think that that not knowing what's out there, I think, is what drives people's imagination. And I think, you know, certainly when I was growing up and Apollo went to the moon and then the space shuttles, that was all, like, it was brand new. And now people just, because there's so much sci-fi, take it for granted that we can go off into space and do this, that and the other. But actually, when, you know, there was an excitement about it was the first thing that happened. And I think they're maybe trying to get that excitement back. I was recently in Florida at SpaceX, and all the excitement around being able to land the spacecraft and all those, you know, it's going back to how it was with Apollo. And then next year when NASA launches to go to Mars, it will be, you know, another fascinating adventure. But why are we going to Mars? You know, what's there? If there's nothing there, maybe there was something there billions of years ago. So maybe, who knows, maybe we came from Mars. And when Mars was going to be barren, they found a way to get to a different planet, the same way we're trying to find a different planet. But I think it's that not knowing that is the fascination behind it all.
I mean, you talked about, you know, about isolation. Obviously, when it's forced upon you, it can be terribly negative. But actually, we were sitting in the middle of London, like a week and a bit before Christmas. This is probably the quietest spot in the city. But periods of isolation aren't necessarily a bad thing.
No, they're good. If I'm writing, I like to be isolated to write. But it's that I'm talking more of loneliness rather than isolation. So self-isolation, wanting to be alone, is a good thing. But sometimes people are looking for company, particularly elderly people and, you know, homeless people, where that loneliness is enforced. I'm sure they do like moments when they want to be alone, but also perhaps, you know, there should be ways and means to be able to share things with them, so share lives with together. So,
and then as we were discussing a little earlier in the program, you have this huge number of people who are, as you say, who are lonely or isolated, not through choice, and yet at the same time, people have never been more connected than they are now.
Yeah, and isn't that the great juxtaposition of all that social media actually also drives this feeling of not being adequate, or, you know, being lonely and having to post all the time and get likes and have that affirmation of what you're doing in your life through likes on social media. So it's a great thing. It's a great tool, but it's like every other tool, like the internet itself, it can be misused. And man always seems to find a way to misuse things, like, you know, rocket technology becomes nuclear bombs. It's strange how we always go down that that path of misusing technology as well.
And but someone once described social media as being a bit like as basically being a video game, that you are collecting points.
Yeah.
It's just you're collecting likes and comments, and it's a sort of form of validation.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. A form of validation, yeah. And if you think of things like simulation theory, where, you know, the people say we're in some big computer simulation, that the world is a computer simulation, and all those other conspiracy theories, there's always some way to manipulate this technology that it's something else than perhaps it is, you know. But like I say, you know, the Earth is, what, 4 billion years old, and the universe is nearly 14 billion years old, and we are just a tiny blink of an eye in
that
time.
That's the problem, isn't it? Yeah. Is that it's something that's quite hard for people to conceive of, those kind of, both the distances involved in space travel, and when you say, you know, Mars is our nearest neighbour, it's not like jumping on the M1, and it's taken us 50 years to get to the point of being able to consider the beginnings of an exploratory mission. This is because it's something that stretches far beyond any of our lives, this sort of route of exploration. Is it maybe just a bit, it is a bit difficult to
grasp? I don't think we can comprehend it. I mean, if you think the universe is constantly expanding, and then you go back to the Big Bang theory, and then you know, well, what was there before? What bang that created the universe? It's beyond our comprehension at the moment. And I think that's why people reach out to religion sometimes, that something must have created all of this, because the science doesn't make sense to a lot of people. So, and then you look at, there's a track on the album called Dark Matter, and Stephen Hawking and others have done some work that of all matter that exists in the universe, humans can only see or feel 5% of it. So there's 95% of matter, dark matter, and things that exist that we we know nothing about. And then they get into quantum physics and all those different areas. So it's a fascinating subject that goes on and on and on. And, you know, what kind of brain thinks about dark matter and discovers it, you know, it's fascinating.
Well, it is absolutely fascinating. The music is extraordinary. Thank you very much for coming in this morning, Paul Kirkpatrick. That new recording is called The Fermi Paradox. And indeed, let's play that track now.
They don't even know they're here. They're so advanced that they know about us, but, you know, they don't care about us because we're so inferior to them that if they don't want to, we'll never find out about their existence. Things of that nature. Solutions of the type that there are some bottlenecks in evolution, either in our past or in our future, such that.
You're listening to Sunday Brunch from Monocle 24. On to our weekend read now, which comes from Ingrid Fetter-Lee, whose book is called Joyful. It explores patterns, colours, textures, shapes that all have one thing in common. They provoke joy. That could be a natural landscape. It could be a cherry blossom. It could be a baby animal. The book aims to inspire people to create more joy in their own lives, as she explained to Henry Rhys Sheridan.
I started working on this book out of a surprising incident that happened while I was studying design. So I'm a designer, and I was in design school, and I had a critique where a bunch of professors were sort of looking at my work, and one of them said that, you know, my work gave them a feeling of joy. And that was really surprising to me because I'd always thought of joy as something that comes from within, right? We're always taught to think of joy as this sort of intangible, elusive thing that we just sort of have to wait for it to happen to us. And when he said that, I started asking, you know, what is it about these things? What is it about tangible things that could create intangible joy? And the professors couldn't answer my question. And so that set me off on this journey that has taken 10 years. I didn't know at the time it was going to take 10 years to try to understand what is the relationship between the physical world around us and the emotional landscape within us. And so when I use the word aesthetics of joy, that's sort of the outcome of that research, where I started to notice that, you know, when I asked people about the tangible things that brought them joy, I started to notice that there were certain universal elements, certain patterns in those things that they mentioned. And those are things like bright color, round shapes, symmetry, abundance, a sense of lightness or elevation. That those things, I call them aesthetics of joy because they are hardwired triggers that we find in the world that can actually produce the feeling of joy inside of us.
One thing that I found interesting about the list of aesthetic features that you've just enumerated that inspire joy in us is that they're not very cool. And what I mean by that is that they're qualities that many contemporary designers would spurn in their idea of what's a sophisticated product design or sophisticated architecture. First of all, do you think that's an accurate take? And second of all, what do you make of it?
You know, I often say that coolness is the opposite of joy, and that joy is really about enthusiasm and a certain earnestness and leaning forward into life. And coolness is so much about detachment, right? And judgment and standing back and looking rationally at the world with sort of a little bit of a disdain in some ways for it. And so they are very much in tension. And I think we have a society, we've evolved a society that really values coolness and detachment and joy, the sort of childlike exuberance that we all feel when we are children, we sort of, that gets pushed out of us. You know, we're told we have to put play aside. We're told that we should wear less color as we get older. So we're often push to put aside joy in favor of this sort of cool cynicism. And I think that it really hurts us. I think that that judgment is actually really damaging because it cuts us off from our natural impulse toward joy. And so I agree. I think modernism, which is an aesthetic that informs a lot of the world around us and a lot of what, you know, is sort of seen as high design, is actually not a very joyful aesthetic. It's very square and rectilinear, and it's not round and it's not colorful. And that, I think, colors our experience of the physical world.
So one aspect of your work is that you recommend ways in which people can design their personal environments to inspire joy. If you could give me two or three main tips or principles that I could apply to this end, what would they be?
Well, the first one I would say is to incorporate more color. So I think, you know, we've all been, because of this design aesthetic, this sort of cool minimalist design aesthetic, we've all sort of pulled a lot of the color out of our lives. And I think it's really powerful when you even just start adding small pops of color back in, when you start to see what happens. And one of the things I love to suggest to people, if they're able to paint their front door, is to paint their front door a bright color, because it's the first thing you see when you come home every night. It's the last thing you see before you leave the house. And it also is something that all your neighbors see. And so it becomes this beacon that adds joy to your area. And bright color is universally considered to be joyful. So it's something that that works across cultures. Another one that I would recommend is round shapes. So this has interesting roots. So if you talk to neuroscientists who study shapes, they'll actually put people into fMRI machines and show them pictures of angular objects and round ones. And what happens is that when people look at angular objects, there's a part of the brain called the amygdala, a little structure involved in fear and anxiety processing. And that structure, when people look at angular objects, it lights up. And when people look at round shapes, at curved shapes and objects, it stays quiet. And so what's interesting is that this is happening even on a very unconscious neurological level, that when we have a lot of sharp angles in our home, it's sort of making us uneasy. And one of the reasons that researchers speculate that this happens is that we evolved in a world where angles meant danger. So thorns and jagged rocks and teeth, those are things to be cautious around. So we evolved this sort of unconscious caution around those shapes. And so when you bring more curves into your home, and that could be around mirror or coffee table, it sort of sets people at ease. It creates less formality and more ease and playfulness in a home.
What are the costs of neglecting joy when it comes to designing public places?
When you actually start to think about the fact that the sensory world influences our well-being in profound ways, you start to understand that actually it is quite expensive to ignore the fact that our spaces have an influence on us. And so, you know, one area that I think when you're talking about schools, you know, maybe curved walls are more expensive, and that, you know, may just be one example that's challenging. But of course, paint is not a, you know, if you're going to paint a building, you're going to paint it anyway. It doesn't cost any more to paint it in colors than it does in gray. I think light, a lot of the research that is coming out on light and nature exposure, I think those are two areas where the research is pretty deep and profound. And, you know, some of the research on children and light shows that children in better lit classrooms actually advance up to 26% faster in their schoolwork than children in dimly lit classrooms. And so, you know, when you start to understand that the environment has an effect on performance, it has an effect on our well-being, then, you know, the costs of not addressing some of these environmental issues are actually quite high.
And are there any industries or places that do joyful design particularly well?
Interesting question. I mean, I think that, you know, there are some industries that are designed more to delight, that focus more on thinking about, you know, our experience. I think about the places that are worst. And the places that are worst tend to be the places where people have no choice but to be there. You know, nursing homes, hospitals, housing projects, prisons, and schools, those are often the places that are worst. And so, you know, I think whenever, you know, we have a choice of a place to be, then I think people are more willing to invest in joyful design.
That's Ingrid Fetter-Lee, whose book Joyful, The Surprising Power of Ordinary Things to Create Extraordinary Happiness is out now. Don't forget, more conversations with authors in our Meet the Writers series. It's all online at monocle.com. Stay with us in just a moment. We'll take a look through the weekend's newspapers.
It's the show presented by me, Andrew Tuck, all about the cities we live in. The show that celebrates urban living, from tough-talking mayors and civic activists to the guy who runs a perfect neighbourhood shop and the woman who, come sunset, turns into a gorilla gardener. The Urbanist is the go-to show for anyone who wants to know what makes a great city, and also a rubbish one, and how good lighting or wise technology could shape their metropolis for the better. Join us every week for sparkling debate, global reports, and some agenda-setting interviews.
We have a chance to shape what the urban environment will be like for billions of people.
The show premieres live every Thursday, or you can subscribe to the program as a podcast at monocle.com or on SoundCloud or iTunes. The Urbanist, a program that knows its good mayors from its planning nightmares.
Time now to take a look through the weekend's newspapers. My guest in the studio, the broadcaster and journalist Juliette Foster. Thank you for coming in this morning.
Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, we can't avoid it. That's just it's like that thing where you've got to tear a plaster off, and it's easier to just do it. So
yeah. Let's just dive in. Talking Brexit. Yeah, Brexit. Really, I've chosen three newspapers here, The Observer, The Sunday Telegraph and The Sunday Times. And I suppose you could say it's variations of the same theme, Brexit. The Observer headline, Brexit deadlock is blocking off vital domestic policy reforms. Hunt, UK will flourish without a Brexit deal. That is Jeremy Hunt, who's the Foreign Secretary. And The Sunday Times, PM's team plots new referendum. I mean, take your pick which of these you believe. But look, when we look at the Brexit coverage, particularly on the television news, it tends to look at what is the Prime Minister going to do now, how are the Europeans going to respond to this, what happens if this fails, what's the next step, and so on and so forth. And what these headlines do is that they broaden things out a bit from that formula. So, Brexit deadlock blocking off vital domestic policy reforms. This is a piece in The Observer. And what they're basically saying is that so much time and energy has been absorbed in trying to sort out the Brexit issue that other things seem to have been kicked into the rough in terms of social policy. And this is quite important because, for example, they say here that you've got a crisis in the NHS. We're now in the winter. And in the winter, the NHS is pushed beyond the limits of anyone's endurance because you've got various cold bugs and goodness knows what else which are happening. The hospital beds are blocked up. People are working very, very hard. We have a crisis in terms of our elderly population. It's a demographic that's being repeated around the world, in fact, that you've got younger people, older people who will need caring for. So what are we going to do about social care? In this country, we have an issue with our railway systems. Now, it used to be on the 1st of January that you'd be told, actually, train fares are going to go up. The railway operators have been a bit kinder because they're telling us a couple of months in advance. But the point about it is that people feel that transport policy in this country is disjointed. They're paying for increases on railway services and the trains aren't running on time. And of course, winter is a testing time because we could get snow in December, or if we don't get it in December, it's going to be in January, but it's going to cause massive transport disruption. If you have huge transport disruption, you tend to find that people can't get to work, so some people will have to work from home. That impacts on businesses. Now, we've grinned and borne this in the past, but 2019, March 2019 to be precise, at the end of, we're supposed to be leaving Europe. And of course, the business community is very worried about leaving without a deal. So if you've actually got a messed up transport system, you've got a crisis in the NHS, and this fear that if you don't get the border issue, the backstop sorted out between Northern Ireland and the Irish Republic, etc., you're going to have lorry queues which are gazillions of miles long around the ports. That kind of adds to the misery. Another social policy issue, knife crime. Now, we know the Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, he's coming up for election, I think it's next year, isn't it, the London Mayor? 2020, the London Mayor elections. Now, this has been the real Achilles heel for him. It is this upsurge in knife crime. What do you do about it? Because young people are getting involved in this. It's not just a London phenomenon, it has to be added. It goes beyond that. It's nationwide, the upsurge in knife crimes and gun crimes, etc. These are important issues that need to be dealt with. That's just a selection of things that I've mentioned here. And it seems that these things have been kicked into the rough, put on the back burner, because Brexit is taking up so much time and so much energy. And that's really the thrust of it. And that is something which is often forgotten about in the Westminster narrative when we look at the Brexit story on the day-to-day.
Well, there is that thing. I mean, there's part of the Observer's editorial comment is on the front page, and it talks about those things. It talks about understaffed hospitals, schools, sending begging letters to parents for financial support, that there are all these things that in the daily lives of the people who are stuck in the middle of this, is actually a much bigger issue day to day than Brexit is. But that presumably this is fueling that sense of a disconnection with political leaders, that it's just none of these things are being addressed.
I entirely agree with you, because you know, in my work, whenever I'm talking, if I'm talking to members of the public or even just in general conversation, people are just fed up of Brexit, because you tend to find that people say, why can't governments just get on with it? Just do it. We voted to leave. Just do it. It's very, very complicated. Now, the government's own Attorney General stressed this when he had to issue those remarks explaining how they reached that decision with Article 50 and the strategy they're taking, et cetera, et cetera. He said, look, it's like a divorce. You know, we've been together for 45 years. We can't just walk away. It's very complicated. So it's a bit of a contradiction that on the one hand, we want things to happen quickly so that we can get the Brexit thing over and done with, to focus on issues here that are happening every single day, that people are living every single day. But on the other hand, it's very difficult to walk away after 45 years without there being some sort of consequence. You want to get something before you just walk away. So it's a strange limbo state in which we find ourselves.
And meanwhile, the Sunday Times reporting there are people at the top of Theresa May's government that are now actively considering and working out how they would stage another referendum. And which is the thing that Theresa May said will not happen.
She said that will not happen. But you see, what fascinates me about this is that if you cast your mind back to earlier in the year, when you had the likes of Alistair Campbell, who was the former Prime Minister Tony Blair's spin doctor, you had Chukwuemeka, who's a Labour MP, young, very articulate, very handsome, tipped as a future leader. You had Justin Greening, who was the former Education Secretary in the Conservative Party. They were saying, look, there has to be a second referendum. There has to be a people's vote. Now, when they put together, or were certainly involved in bringing together this movement, this idea, it was dismissed. People say, look, it's just sour grapes. You've got to accept that we've had this referendum. People have voted. And now, all of a sudden, an idea which was seen as wacko is suddenly finding itself at the heart of the political establishment. Now, OK, Chukwuemeka, Justin Greening and various other supporters, yes, they were there. They were part of this political establishment. But the fact is that it's not been kicked as or dismissed as easily, perhaps, as it was before. If you have a second vote, I mean, is it going to be a second referendum? Are we saying that we put to people the same question in 2019, whenever this may happen, that was put to them in 2016? In other words, do you stay in Europe or do you leave Europe? Or do you say, no, what we do is that we actually broaden the questions, OK? Because the argument in favour of this referendum is that when people voted, it was a yes or a no. What they didn't tell the government was how we want to exit Europe, because the question wasn't posed. And it does appear as if for the majority of the public who voted to leave Europe, whilst they're in favour of getting out, they don't like the idea of a hard Brexit. Leaving Europe is treading into the unknown, but leaving without a deal, that's quite scary, because you really are raising the stakes of vulnerability.
But then it gets really complex, because there's a lot.
Exactly.
The article says that the government, some people in government are considering a referendum where they say the choices are to leave the EU with no deal or to leave the EU
with a deal.
With Theresa May's deal, which presumably by that point would already have been rejected by
MPs. Absolutely, because she's actually pushed it forward to next month.
But then there is this theory, apparently, that what would then happen is that MPs would add a third option to that when it went through the Commons, giving people the chance to vote to stay in the EU, which means it's a referendum with three possible outcomes. So how do we, when you consider how much argument we've had when the last result was 52-48, if you have three outcomes, it's very hard to imagine any one outcome will get more than half the votes.
Or maybe what you do, because I agree with you, because obviously people are going to respond to the different questions. So what do you do if you actually get all of them, so many, a certain percentage, all pretty much coming up the same way, saying, OK, I'll vote for this option and that. You're still gridlocked. So what John Major, the former Prime Minister, advocated was just basically revoking Article 50. Now, he wants to stay in Europe. You could argue, OK, let's revoke Article 50, because you had the court judgment a few days ago which said that Britain could actually do that, so you stay in Europe. But then the strategy is, OK, revoke Article 50. Let's have a plan, OK, about how we're going to get out of Europe, because clearly people want to leave Europe. And yeah, then we can trigger it, because at least we'll have something concrete to go to actually start negotiations with. Because, again, this is one of the criticisms that's been levelled at Theresa May, that because she was trying to prove her Brexit credentials to the sceptics in her government, she triggered Article 50 before the actual exit plan had been forged. It's a bit like going into playing poker against one of the world's best poker players and you haven't studied them. You don't know where their weaknesses are, so you don't know how to attack them, and you're a bit surprised that you get clobbered in the match.
I think we seem to be perpetually surprised. Let's move, because it's not just Britain that's having political turmoil at the moment. We've just had a fifth weekend of protests in France, smaller in number than the previous ones, but still, those demonstrators aren't going away yet.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I chose this story because it just shows you that Theresa May, she can draw some consolation from the fact that she's not the only European leader having a hard time at home. In this case, it is Emmanuel Macron, the president of France. Now, and you're absolutely correct. You've had these protests which have now run into the fifth week. Yes, or weekend, I should say. Yes, the turnout was slightly lower than expected, but then that was understandable because a few days ago you had that terrorist attack in the Strasbourg Christmas fair. So understandably, a lot of people were scared and probably kept back. But the anger hasn't subsided. And Macron did what some would say, well, he should have done earlier in the game before it got to the stage where it is now. He actually made concessions. So the concessions that he made in his televised address was that he announced a £13.4 billion package of concessions, including a rise in the minimum wage. And that was important because he said he'd never do that. OK, but then he was forced to actually back down from that. But it still hasn't bought people off because they've said, look, you know, we don't believe you. You're just simply trying to buy us off with these concessions. And once everything's calmed down, then you'll pick up where you left off. But when you read this article, I'm not quite sure what the protesters want. And
It started with the sort of fuel tax. Now it just seems to have evolved into a general sense of unhappiness.
It's a general sense of unhappiness. But for example, they've quoted somebody here who is from the RIC, which is the Referendum d'Initiative Citoyenne, Citizens Initiative Referendum. And they want the French constitution to be rewritten to allow the people greater political power and a reduction in tax on essential goods, including food, heating, water and clothing. Our elected representatives need to be controlled when they betray us. So, yes, we all want reductions in the cost of living, etc. But I'm a little bit confused rewriting.
It's a bit of a woolly aim,
It is a very woolly aim because we all want a cheaper standard of living. There's nothing unusual about that. It's universal. But to rewrite the constitution so that the public can bring politicians under control, what is that? What does that mean? I'm not quite sure. And that's the thing, because you've got just reading some of the people who've been quoted here, you've had people who are saying, oh, we're pacifists, we're afraid there might be violence, but you come anyway, we have come anyway, otherwise we'll gain nothing in life. We're fighting against a precarious existence. There's too much injustice between those at the top of society and those at the bottom. We're doing this for our children. I don't quite understand it.
No.
I get the frustration, and in many respects that frustration is also reflected in the United Kingdom, if you look at the wider context of the Brexit vote, because it has actually widened those divisions which existed already, which is why we had the intervention of the Archbishop of Canterbury calling for a greater peace, people working together. No church intervention in France, so far as I can see. But it does, I think you hit the nail on the head when you said that this is a little bit woolly. And my suspicion is that eventually it probably will peter out, but it is having a poisonous effect, particularly on the French economy, because this is a time when businesses should be selling, but they've actually had to board up their shops over the weekend to protect them. It's impacting on the French economy, and it becomes a circle which feeds on itself, because if the economy is weakened as a result of this, then the government may well have to go a bit tighter, may have to, I mean, I'm not sure about French austerity, if there is austerity, but it may have to introduce some
forms.
It may get worse. So it becomes a circle which feeds on itself.
Just very briefly before we end, just tell me about religious Christmas stamps.
Yeah, this
Nobody wants them anymore.
Yeah, this is the Royal Mail. This is a story which appeared in the Sunday Telegraph. It is on page 13. And basically, the Royal Mail, they issue two sets of stamps for Christmas. You've got the religious stamps and you've also got secular stamps. So what they're basically saying, and what some people are saying, is that the secular stamps tend to be more popular than the religious-themed stamps. So the traditionalists, they're very upset about this. But you could argue that, I mean, the Royal Mail has said that they're not actually cutting down on the religious prints. It's just that people aren't taking them. But then on the other hand, I mean, I bought some stamps with my husband yesterday, and we just said, look, can we have a book of stamps?
Nobody gave me a choice.
You didn't get a choice, and that's the whole point. So it's not to say that the post offices don't have these. okay, but I guess you have to be specific. But on the other hand, maybe...
Can I have a book of religious stamps, please?
Yeah, some people do that. I mean, I guess the same way you want first editions of, I don't know, what the latest... Because, you know, they sometimes hook the stamps to a particular theme that they're trying to promote. It could be British artists or something, first day covers. But there are some people who are very specific, who actually say, look, can I have some religious stamps? If you don't ask, you don't get.
Then ask, you don't get.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, at the same time, you could argue that maybe the reason why people aren't being specific is because people aren't really into church. People tend to go to church on special occasions. It could be a christening, it could be a wedding, it could be a funeral. If, of course, the person who's died requested a church funeral. Some people want humanist funerals. But also as well, you've got special events on the calendar like Christmas and Easter, then yeah, we can't get enough of the church. It's nice to go there. But yeah, for the rest of the time, it's a lot of people tend to keep away, which
I did not know that you got a choice of stamp. I mean, I've learned that I can actually go in and ask for my choice of stamp.
Yeah, but you see, that's the thing. If you want religious stamps, they are being sold.
You just have to ask.
You've just
got
to ask for them.
Right, well, there we are.
It's common sense.
That's how you basically say. Perhaps if that was a sign saying that, then we wouldn't have this fall in sales, but who knows?
We might even get a Brexit stamp.
Oh, let's not. We're already getting a coin. Juliet Foster, thanks very much.
Cheers, thank you.
You're listening to Sunday Brunch from Monocle 24. Well, finally today, and perhaps appropriately for our programme, we end with a little brunch, specifically buns, because my final guest today has opened a bun shop in London. It's after the buns served at his pub became so popular that people were queuing out the door to get hold of them. John Rotherham is with me in the studio. How did you end up in this position of people normally go to pubs for a drink, even if they're going to have some food. People don't normally say, let's pop down the pub for a bun.
Well, that was the idea behind it. We always we wanted to introduce a bar snack to go with a beer or whatever you wanted to be drinking at the bar. And we thought that this was a great little vessel to have a little, you know, you can hold it in one hand and you can use your other hand to drink with. It's kind of got the filling inside of the bun, so it's not messy.
We ought to explain for people who, because obviously a bun is a loaded word that has lots of different meanings to different people. So when we're talking about a bun, what are we talking about in this context?
Okay, so in this context, we're talking about a savoury bun that has been baked, and then it's got a savoury filling in the middle. Essentially, suppose like a warm pie, but in this case, it's a bun. And they have very different, you know, sort of savoury bits inside of them.
Sort of things?
So we've got beef and barley buns. That was the kind of the house favourites. That was the one we started with. So you can imagine it's a minced beef with lots of toasted barley, lots of porter, lots of stout goes into it. And that sort of filled inside of the bun. So when you bite into it, you get that lovely warm beef mince. Then we've got for breakfast, we have a bacon bun, which is very popular on a Sunday morning.
I can imagine.
Down in the markets. So we have that as a bacon bun. We also like a little spin-off. We've got a curried lamb bun, which works quite well with the lagers and the things at the bar.
And then it sort of exploded, and it just became people were primarily coming for the buns.
Well, that was it. So on a Sunday morning, a lot of people queue up on the market just to get the buns before they go to the markets, get a cup of tea and a bun. And people started to, you know, queue up for the beef and barley buns. They kind of pre-order them at the bar, which is quite nice. And yeah, it just exploded from there.
And so this idea is like, actually, there's a completely separate business concept here.
Exactly. There was a spin-off of that. We thought, hang on here, there's this pretty good idea behind this. So it was a spin-off from the Marksman. So we wanted to do open it up something quiet on its own, something unique to itself. And then we could play with the different varieties of buns and different seasons which work with it.
So where is it?
So this one's at Market Halls in Victoria. We thought it'd be a great little place to launch it because it is a grab-and-go concept and it's a very busy area around there for, you know, people going on the trains or hanging around in bars around there. So we wanted to launch it there because we thought it'd be nice to do something quite different and away from the East End and, you know, people in West London were asking.
It does sound like, I mean, it's someone who sort of hangs around railway stations, sounds very strange, but is always waiting at railway stations to get trains somewhere.
Yeah.
That the one thing that railway stations desperately need is some decent food to take on the train, because that's the one thing they generally don't have.
Exactly.
Unless you want like a pre-made sandwich in a box.
Yeah, all those horrible smells that open up when you're on the train with someone. So that's the great thing about them, is that they are so versatile. You know, you can eat it on the train or when you get home or wherever you're going, and they don't take long to warm up. So you can always eat them on the go or just as they are. And we just thought it'd be fun to do this shop, really. That was the idea behind it. We wanted to do something different, and we didn't want to necessarily put it in East London to start with. We wanted to try somewhere else to see how the market went.
Now, you say try somewhere else. This could be the beginning of a bigger thing then.
Well, the idea is to have a spin-off and have many of these little shops popping up all over the place. The great thing is that you don't need a big space for them. You know, we're looking at small little concessions that we can kind of open up and, you know, try it out from there.
So this, I could be picking this up at a railway station, because if you don't travel out of Victoria, so
well,
it's one part.
Well, that's it. I just don't understand, you know, people are catching trains, they still want good quality foods. You know, it seems like it's the only area at the moment that doesn't have those sort of concessions. It's not just for train stations.
To be fair, people also want trains that go on time, and they don't get those either.
Exactly.
So it's not like the food's the only disappointment.
Well, hopefully we can cheer them up a little bit while they're waiting for a train. But yeah.
So this morning, you've got people queuing right now outside the pub.
Well, what happens
you've
in the morning?
You've abandoned them.
Abandoned them to come here. But basically what happens is that people queue up to get them in the morning, or they say they're coming back, they're popping back. They sort of pre-order them. I have many friends who, you know, for Christmas time, like to pre-order them, like a mince pie.
I was going to say, is there a Christmas variation?
At the moment we're doing a duck and prune bun, which we, a little spin, you know, we roast some duck, pick it down and put some chopped prunes for it, and that's a spin-off for Christmas time.
Well, if you could get one open at Euston Station, that would be really, really helpful. John Robin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming in this morning, I'll have to free you to return to your queue. That's it for this edition of Sunday Brunch, produced and studio managed by George McDonough. Our researcher was Mariana Glaster. We'll have the best of the sessions of Padori House in just a moment. An hour from now, a new Monocle Weekly and a news update in just a moment. For the moment, though, from me, thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.